Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show that explores all avenues of transformation and aims to offer some useful nuggets that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature, no matter how contrary that might seem, just like this nightingale, the bird that sings out in the dark. I'm JJ, the practical alchemist, and I'm delighted you could join me today with my guest, Jim Steele. Jim is a speaker, a coach, and a leadership facilitator who has a particular interest in the role of well-being in high performance. He's developed a program called Unashamedly Superhuman, which promotes strategies for building resilience and tackling stress. And now he has a book that everyone can benefit from, not just business leaders, and it's called Unashamedly Superhuman. And you might find a lot of very useful tips in it if you've been setting some goals for yourself. I caught up with Jim recently to find out more. At the very beginning of your book, Unashamedly Superhuman, we'll talk about what we mean by that shortly. We have a rather interesting picture, before and after picture of you. And Well, let's just say that in one of the pictures, you're standing there, a fag in one hand, a glass of red in the other. Could have been me when I was younger.
and I think I say, and quite literally, breasts.
Yes, man boobs.
Yeah. Moobs.
Yeah. Moobs. But then you have another picture just next to it showing you after you crossed the finishing line on the 2nd of September 2021 after doing, well, you tell me.
Yeah, well, yes. And I put it right at the beginning of the book because I wasn't setting this up with any jeopardy. You know, the book isn't about me doing this Ironman triathlon is the label which they give to it, which I'm a little uncomfortable with. I think it's a bit selective, that. But anyway, that's the phrase they use. And I was just promoting the fact that I wanted to take something on whilst I was researching, trying to underpin some observations around performance and well-being and trying to tie these two things together with a tangible challenge, something that was so ridiculous. And you're right, the reason I put the image of me at the party was literally about a month before I set the goal to do this triathlon. And I just come out of hospital. I had my third knee operation. I had a couple of discs fused in my lower spine, some rods screwed in some years before. And I only mention that because structurally I was on the decline. And in fact, the surgeon said to me, "You really have to stop running now." And I said, I get what you're saying, but I haven't run for years. I said, so he said, look, you've got to take something up that's a little less intense and you're not built for this. So my belief systems were I was on the decline and I genuinely wasn't feeling particularly good about that as I, you know, I was sort of coming to the end of my 50s thinking, what are the 60s and 70s going to look like? So when I took on this challenge, it was to provoke a radical change in approach and to learn some strategies for, you know, structure, biomechanics, well-being, if you like, because the goal was not only to finish this thing, and I gave myself a year initially, it was also to finish it well. It was to learn some ways of getting to the end of this event and at the end of the day, literally the end of the day, feel as good as I felt at the beginning. And I, of course, you're going to be exhausted, you're going to be tired, you're going to be aching. But the goal wasn't to be injured or hurt.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Because I probably would have pushed through and found a way to do it. And then, like everything else I've done in my life, ended up in hospital, you know. So I was very mindful. And I was initially provoked by a client, actually, who runs a global team for a firm. And she said, I want to try and come up with some ideas that combine high performance and well-being. And this was probably 4 years ago at a time when well-being really wasn't on the mission statements of many organizations. And in fact, you know, I come out of the 90s where, you know, burnout was a badge of honor. It was almost like first in, last out. And, you know, thankfully that's changed now. So I took this challenge seriously and I just needed to go and find a way to explore some content because I really didn't know. I was almost of a mind of saying, I mean, you know, you're either a full tilt go-getter or you look after yourself. I don't know if you can combine these things. So this metaphor of this triathlon was just a way of me having something tangible that either did or didn't work. You know, I had no idea whether I could, literally, physically, psychologically, emotionally. whether I could get through it, whether I would not keel over. So to take that on was pivotal. And originally I wasn't going to put it, I didn't have the book deal when I did it, but I wasn't going to put it in the book. The reason I chose to was because it's a dotted line. There are plenty of people out there that have done far greater in feats of endurance that didn't deem them to be book worthy. And I get that. But for me, it was just like I was kind of tacking alongside the observations I was making. And therefore, I could reference it back. And it's almost right at the end of the book where I put a chapter in where I tell you, let me tell you what happened. If you're interested, by all means, skip through this chapter, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And then so partly the outcome of all of that was, though, the book called Unashamedly Superhuman.
Yeah.
Harness your inner power and achieve your greatest professional and personal goals. Well, you certainly achieved a massive goal, in my mind anyway, because I would never dream of doing something like that. I don't consider myself to be particularly athletic or sporty. Sport's a bit of a bad word in my home. But but I do swim, and we'll come to that a bit later. And a lot of people who know me, who listen to the show, will know that. But unashamedly superhuman. Now, what do you mean by that?
Yeah. So I chose the title for a couple of reasons. One, I thought it's quite provocative in that, you know, who's sitting there going, they're superhuman? That's a ridiculous thing to say, right? And frankly, and perhaps we'll come back to this as we have a conversation, superhuman is the sexy word. Unashamedly is the more important word. And that evolves in the book, because unashamedly superhuman is once you've realized that my job is to prove to you that you are, and you have quite a remarkable set of systems built in that can lend itself to, you know, quite incredible achievements. And there are plenty of those documented through time. But this really wasn't about those select few that have achieved the remarkable. That wasn't my intention with the book. I could have gone out and found superhuman people and made them the study and gone, that's what you got to do. But I couldn't relate to that. And I wanted to really come at it from the angle of anybody has within them these systems. Now, whether we access them and whether we test them is a whole other question, you know. So similarly, I didn't see myself as athletic, and the first picture would be evidence of that.
Anybody who reads the book, you have a look at it, you'll see.
So, you know, I'm hoping that I was coming at it. The reason that metaphor worked for me was, you know, look, for some, it may not be a physical challenge. It could be business. It could be emotional. It could be relationship. It could be all manner of things we're trying to achieve in our life. And I wanted to just sort of demystify some of the things that underpin this phrase, unashamedly superhuman. And the definition of superhuman, when I started looking into this, it's a term that refers to the ability to do things not naturally found in humans. That's what it said on Wikipedia. So it's already saying it's not normal. Mm-hmm. Right. And it said these superhuman can be achieved through three things, either through a unique ability. So there are some people that are born with a God-given ability that's just remarkable. I take that. That's not me. And that's not most people I know. So that wasn't my point. The second thing it talks about is technological aids. You know, we kind of walk around with our phones strapped to our hand that do give us tremendous access to uplift our performance. I can calculate all sorts of calculations at a heartbeat. I have access to all manner of information, right? So that wasn't my point. And look, and you could take it to the extreme. I mean, Elon Musk's in the news quite a lot at the moment for all sorts of reasons, but one of his companies, Neuralink, you know, talks about having computer chips implanted into our brain that give us access to all manner of superhuman capabilities. I don't want to go anywhere near that. That's just way too frightening.
Me neither.
Right?
Yeah.
But the third thing it said was, or by tapping, well, it actually said by self-actualization, which I looked into as being tapping your full potential.
Yeah.
Whatever that is. And as much as I was kind of inspired by that, I was always also challenged by that, because it's so vague, you know, tapping potential. What does that even mean? You know, and it's a question I ask people a lot on podcasts and at conferences. You know, intuitively, how much of your potential do you feel like you're tapping? What's your number? You know, and I don't mean effort. You could be given everything, but how much do you feel you're tapping into? And I remember I first asked that question right in the middle of lockdown on a webinar. There's a couple of thousand people, and the numbers came pouring into the chat box. Everything, you know, 20%, 80%, 60%, 19%. I mean, very specific answers. But what no one ever taps in is 100% ever.
Right. Yeah.
No one ever says, I'm tapping everything, Jim. I got nothing left. Right. all we kind of intuitively feel there's something to be had.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to try and do was demystify that, because certainly the corporate sector that I operate in predominantly is full of cliche, you know, and things like we got to tap our potential, we got to change our mindset, we got to become more resilient, all said with good intention, but of no use to me, right?
Well, nobody tells you why or how, or even says what they mean by that. It's just a phrase. Yeah.
It's a phrase, and it feels good, but you walk away going, I don't know what I've taken from that. And I wanted to find some processes, I mean, genuinely some processes, some hacks, some strategies that anyone can go and test and use and go, wow, that's interesting. Wow, I had no idea, you know. And yeah. I remember years ago when my first sales job, I was selling corporate insurance, and my manager was an American guy, lovely guy, very enthusiastic. And after a full day of failure, I'd ring him up and I'd say, I've sold nothing. I've done nothing. I've got one more call to make. I'll do it tomorrow. And he'd say, come on, Jim. He'd say, make the call, finish on a high. And he'd try and motivate me. Mm-hmm. And he'd say, and I'd heard it 1,000 times. He'd go, come on, Jim, be positive. And I kind of put the phone down going, I know, be positive. His intentions were good, right?
Yeah.
But you can't even argue with it. You can't go, no, right? But there's no value in the statement. It's almost like, you know, do you ever get those days when you think, I've earned this depression and I'm going to have it, right? And frankly,
yeah.
The last thing I want is someone saying, you know, change your mindset. I go, yes, correct. What I needed him to say was, Jim, do this, this, and this. Do these three things
exactly.
in this order, and yeah. you're going to feel so focused. You're going to want to make the call. That's what I needed, right? And that was the sort of setup for the book, was that, yeah. you know, instead of being in awe of the magician who creates the magic, you know, be in awe of their strategy. Look for the strategy that's creating the illusion. And that's what this book was about. And Unashamedly Superhuman is, you know, it starts off with that provocative assumption. But by the end of it, I'm hoping people will walk away going, do you know what? You can't argue with it. Yes, I am.
Yeah, well, I think that's a brilliant way of explaining it. And I think that you achieve that in the book, because one of the things that struck me was that it is full of just really absolutely practical strategies, things to do, mindset, ideas, tools that you can, anybody can use. Anybody
yeah.
can
yeah, literally.
Use. Yeah. yeah. You don't need anything special. You don't need to be, you know, although you do mention something, which was the first I'd heard of it, a whoop band wearing on your lip.
Strap.
I have never heard of that in my life. And I'm absolutely, you know, I can't tell you how much I can't stand the idea of wearing something on my wrist that tells me everything about me. But I learned loads.
I understand that. And look, and similarly, you know, paralysis by analysis, you know, following your biometrics and, you know, tracking your average heart rate and your heart rate variability and your body temperature and your oxygen levels. And, you know, but what it did, I think it was fascinating, was when I got the whoop strap, because somebody in the sports arena yeah. said, look, if you're going to train for this thing, you've got to put as much focus on recovery as you do
yeah.
the performance. Right. Yeah. And I had never considered that. And they said, if you have this piece of kit that every morning will tell you when you wake up, it'll give you a number. And it will say, based on the last 24 hours, and it factors in everything, all the training sessions, the running, the swimming, the biking, whatever it might be. And also it factors in psychological stress. So things that deplete you at an energy level, which I, again, was really not that mindful of. Mm-hmm. And it says, and you wake up and it goes, right, 60% recovered. And it says, you're ready to take on strain. Now, what happened, which was completely blew me away and it changed my strategy dramatically, was I woke up one morning and it said I was 19% recovered, and it said, focus on recovery.
Wow.
And I thought 19%, 90% is like you've had an all night party and you ran a marathon yesterday. I mean, that's like 90% is like you are depleted.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what did I do yesterday? And I thought, I didn't even train yesterday. How can it be 90? And I thought the thing was faulty. So I looked into the data on the app. And it had these two strain points. It gives you the strain points from the day before. And so I looked at the strain points, and normally it would say three-hour bike ride, 60-minute swim. And you go, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I need to relax, you know, rest a bit today. Mm-hmm. But there was two strain points, and they were both two 90-minute speeches that I did, sat on a stool virtually at two conferences. And I looked at the data. My average heart rate was 128 beats a minute for these two speeches. That's the same as going for a run.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah.
And I thought to me, that was like, I was like eye opening. Like what? My whole system was under strain because of these two 90-minute speeches where I didn't even get off my stool. That was a game changer. Because then I started really thinking about recovery and things like sleep and exercise, nutrition, of course, the obvious things, but other things in terms of stress management, decompressing, resetting, finding ways to restore yourself, not just on the weekend after a full week, but during the process of the day between meetings. So that by the end of the day, you know, it's almost like you get home with something left in the tank. You know, rather than your family getting what's left of you, you know, you have a way of managing your energy levels during the day, so that when you get home, you still have something to offer, and that was a game changer for me.
I mean, I think that's really eye opening, and the whole process of recovery, of restoring your health, your well being, your energy levels, so overlooked. And how many of us have gone home after a hard day's work absolutely drained, and we say, I'm completely drained, I'm exhausted, but then we might sort of, you know, carry on, there might be further stresses and strains, so we don't take the time to look after ourselves and get the rest that we need.
Well, and even just some sort of cognitive decompression. I mean, and this is not complex. I mean, there are some really interesting neuroscience hacks that people can use, and I talk about a number of them in the book. But
you do,
you know, even just pausing and just going, you know, I'm going to find 10 minutes three times a day, just to switch off. And I know what it's like. People are busy, and it's like, you know, that's 30 minutes I could be doing something productive. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like this mindset that stopping is a waste of time. And I had that mindset, no question. And also, I was burning out. That's not in doubt, especially when the pandemic hit. I spent my living flying around the world, speaking at conferences indoors. So all of a sudden, there had no value attached to that. It wasn't even allowed. So, you know, for me, the impact on my energy levels was quite significant. So finding ways to psychologically regroup became really important for me. And, so having some recovery process and some strategies that just allow you to regroup, reset, and then go again. And that was the other thing with me, with recovery. There's a whole, you know, well-being genre out there that I respect, you know, and I find fascinating. That really wasn't where I was tacking towards. Mm-hmm. My focus was performance.
Yeah.
You know, when I set this, even as the metaphor with this triathlon, the goal was to complete the triathlon in under the global average for all finishers of an Ironman. The global average for all finishers was 12 hours, 33 minutes.
Wow.
So it wasn't, recovery for me was, I need to recover sufficiently that I can go again, that I can push harder. You know, performance, and most of my clients, they're focused on performance. So I'm not saying well-being to me is about just relaxing. Far from it. It's about restoring so you can pick it up and you go back in and take more stress. So stress is an inevitable part of our day. You know, even in tapping potential, you need stress to tap potential.
Yes, we do. Well, while you're digesting all of that, let's take a short break now so that we can hear from our sponsors. We'll be right back after this.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and my guest, Jim Steele. Speaking of always feeling the need to do something, Jim offers the 60-60-60 rule that allows us to do nothing because we're actually doing something. Very clever.
Yeah, I love that phrase. And I tell you, two things happened. One, I interviewed a guy called Phil Jones, who's the managing director of Brother UK. I was at a conference last year, a national sales conference, interviewed a few people, some fascinating individuals. And when I asked about recovery, and I wasn't leading the witness, I was just curious to see what their thoughts were. And he talked about that. He said, when I took on the role to take on the business, which was a step up in terms of intensity and demand, somebody, one of his mentors said, you need to find a way to block out time during the day. You can't just wait to the weekend. And he says, and he frames it as, you need to make this part of your high performance strategy. And he used the phrase you used, you've got to give yourself permission to do nothing. Now, doing nothing, we can do more than nothing in terms of we can do things that are genuinely restorative, like active recovery. Now, that might include a whole range of things from breath work to meditation. And maybe we'll demystify that if we get a chance to.
Yeah.
To take a walk in nature, to sit in the garden and just relax. I mean, whatever it might be that allows you to restore yourself. But doing nothing, even that 60, 60, 60 was every 60 minutes. If you sat like this, looking at a screen, you know, dialed in, focused, you know, trying to push yourself through your day, meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting, every 60 minutes, look at something 60 feet away for 60 seconds. You could even dial it down to every 20 minutes, look at something 20 feet away for 20 seconds, because during that process of just disconnecting, again, our cognitive function just gets a little reset. It's not like you're having a nap. You know, I mean, some people, look, if you're a napper, hats off to you. Look, I envy the napper. I'd love to be a napper. I got this FOMO. I fear of missing out. I can't get myself to do it. But if you can nap, that's great. But if you can't nap, at least every hour, pause, look at something 60 feet away, which causes you to take in peripheral information. Because when you're focused, your pupils dilate and you dial in. And you're not aware of anything else, which is super effective when you're focused and you're in the zone, right? But it's exhausting. It takes energy, right? So to pause, especially if you've got a stressful day, and just take in peripheral information. You know, the reason it works when you go for a walk and you get a bit of nature, why does that? Why does everyone feel like that's a great way of decompressing? Well, because when you walk outside, your brain then starts to process because your eyes see more information. And what that causes, it causes you to go into this parasympathetic nervous system, this sort of this resting state rather than this amped up state. It's a bit like a simple analogy. If you look at animals, you know, you look at hunting animals, their eyes are faced that way, right? They're focused.
Facing forward, yeah.
Prey.
Yeah.
Right. You look at grazing animals, their eyes are on the side of their head. You look at like a cow or a horse, they'll stand mm-hmm. there looking particularly chilled. And if you see, you see some of these documentaries, you know, on the plains of Africa where the wildebeest are being chased by the lion. Well, sure, at that point, they're just running for their lives. Within about 20 seconds of the lion giving up, they all stop and start grazing again.
Yes,
they
that's
go,
true.
They go to a resting state rapidly. And the reason they can is because their eyes can take in peripheral information so they feel safe, that they can see that there's no threat right now. Now, there's something in that, right? And I go, so therefore, it's the same logic. You know, every hour, stop 60 feet away, look at something, so you're getting a broad perspective of data, and it causes you to trip into this parasympathetic system, which is a little less hyped up, just for a minute, and then, bang, you're back in again. Right? Yeah. If it gives you 5%, a little 5% uplift, this sort of marginal gain. But if you did that, you know, five times a day, it adds up. You know, in terms of our cognitive performance, it adds up. So, yeah, there's something in all that.
Oh, no, I totally am with you on that. But there are so many gems in this book. You know, one of the chapter headings is accept the adventure. And I had this conversation with a friend the other day who said, you know, oh, what do you think? So-and-so's told me that I won't be able to do that. Well, why are you listening to that? Just embrace it.
Yeah,
you know?
Look, I love, yeah, I picked up this idea of accept the adventure. Listen to an academic talk about potential. Because, you know, my observations around potential across the years have been conferences, the corporate sector, it's all mm-hmm. very ambiguous and, you know, a bit abstract. And this academic talk, I heard him talk about this process of how to tap potential. I thought, this is going to be interesting. He said, so one, you need situational stress or you need an ambition, something that causes you to go, I don't quite know how to do this, but I'm interested to find out if
yeah.
I can.
Yeah.
At some point, he says, you're going to hit the wall and you're going to go, I just don't know if I'm up to this. And maybe you've got to go and learn something and develop yourself during the process. But it's that situation, that situational stress, like I mentioned earlier, that causes the brain to start challenging the pathways of our thinking. So that's potential. You start accessing new ways of thinking, new ways of operating. The idea of the adventure, and that goes back to classic psychology, you know, the hero's journey, you know.
Yes.
The adventure
yeah.
is... Why does that word work so well? One of the fastest growing sports over the last 10 years, I found, were things like Tough Mudder, Spartan runs, these action adventure sports where people go out and they crawl through the muddy fields at 6 a.m. for 4 hours, climbing over obstacles. They're very popular. And you go, why would they do that? Well, there's something intuitive about that where you go, when I come out the other side of it, I probably would have learned something about myself. I probably would have got a sense of achievement. But the reason they use adventure as the word is because the word adventure causes us to lean in, right? And the great thing about an adventure, and I often ask people, the, you know, audiences this, what words come to mind when I say the word adventure? And you get all sorts, things like, you know, challenge, excitement, risk, danger, the unknown, right? Development. And I go, yeah, so these aren't positive or negative, not solely one or the other. It's a mixture of it all, right? But when you go, there's an adventure, it triggers dopamine in the system. And when you get a little dopamine, it puts you on the front foot. So you almost psychologically lean in. If I go, hey, there's an adventure to go on, you kind of go, what is that you say, an adventure? You kind of lean into it. You don't go on the back foot, right?
Yeah.
So even though the reality of what your friend is setting out to do has unknown and challenge and risk and all of that, and I totally get that, and I found that certainly with this triathlon, mm-hmm. As soon as I pulled the umbrella around it, it went, look, this is just part of the adventure. I know it's semantics. I know I'm just playing with words. I'm not trying to be overly positive. In fact, it's more of a pragmatic strategy because it's a cognitive reframe. You're reframing everything into this word that triggers, you know, good chemicals,
yes.
Right? And if I say to people, look, think about the last 3 years. Man, it's been intense. I mean, for some, I got some clients that have done this, and I got some that have fallen off a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, but it's been a remarkable, you know, a period of time that nobody was expecting, nobody was looking for. But if I say, look, I don't know about you, but the last 2 or 3 years have been an adventure. Whew, man. And I said, I don't know what's going to happen for the next 12 months, but I tell you something, it's going to be an adventure.
Yeah.
It already feels a little bit better, right? And it's not changing the reality of it, but what it's changing is the neurochemistry. And as soon as we get a little dopamine in our system, you almost kind of feel like, well, I'm going to move towards it and see what happens. I'm going to explore it because that kind of goes hand in glove with the concept of an adventure. So, yeah, the word is, I think it's a good word. Even if you don't say it out loud, you know, say it inside your head, it still works.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. It's a great word. And then also, the thing is not to be afraid of failure. Now, you tell a really good story to illustrate this, and that's the Boris Becker story.
Well, that was fascinating for me because at the time I was going back to my sales days, you know, with my enthusiastic manager, and I got promoted. I had a team, and I was trying to communicate to them the concept that, you know, selling's quite hard. You get a lot of rejection, you get a lot of failure, and, you know, to work through that. And that's not just in sales, but in all areas of life, you know, fear of failure and you know, fear of rejection, fear of embarrassment is, you know, it will shut you down in terms of your performance because it triggers cortisol, too much adrenaline. You know, you get no dopamine, right? So I didn't know any of that at the time, but I was watching Becker. He was playing in Germany at the Munich Cup. It was the biggest tournament at the end of the year. It was the final hurrah back in the sort of late 80s. They brought this new tournament in. It was the richest tournament, $2 million for the winner. And it was all the Grand Slam winners and runners up. The top eight from the year would come together and play for a winner-take-all prize. The winner took everything.
So it was a massive tennis event.
It was a massive tennis event. Yeah. And he was known that he wanted to win it. It was his home tournament, really. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so he gets to the final. He's playing Pete Sampras. He wins the first set comfortably. And then Sampras turns him over, beats him 3-1. And I was big. I loved tennis as a kid. That was my thing. So I was watching this interview afterwards. And the interviewer said, you know, talk us through what happened. I mean, you're a setup. It's yours for the taking. And he was like, yeah, look, I'm disappointed, you know, but, you know, that's tennis. It happens. And they said, yeah, but, you know, you must be devastated. He went like, I'm not devastated. I'm disappointed. I'm a competitive guy. And they said, yeah, but, you were set up. He said, look, you might have noticed, he said, that last couple of sets, as he said, Sampras started serving this wide cut serve to my backhand. He said, I had no response. I didn't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but I tell you something, I will for the next time I play him. And then the phrase that I picked out of the interview was, I may not have beaten him today, but I've learned how to beat him. And that's worth more than $2 million to me. And I thought, wow, that's a really interesting paradigm on loss, on failure. And what he was talking to, and I suppose nowadays we call it a growth mindset after Carol Dweck's book, he was talking about playing a win-learn game. In other words, and I often say to people, you know, if I said, who likes to win? Yeah, I like to win, yeah. Who likes to fail? Well, no one likes to fail. Who likes to learn? Yeah, no, I'll take a learn. No one's moving away from winning or learning. Both of those trigger dopamine. So if the perception is, no matter what I do, if I give 100% of this endeavor, and the worst thing that happens is I learn, genuinely learn, and I pay attention, And I raise my awareness and I think about what did I learn that didn't work out? What did I learn I got to get better at? And based on that, I change my approach moving forward. The only option is progress, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to be overly positive. It's a pragmatic process. But what that does is it removes failure as an outcome. And if you don't fear failure, then it keeps you above the line. It keeps you in this resourceful state where most of your skills will show up. And if your skills aren't good enough, that's part of the learning process. But at least you won't walk away going, I could have done better than that. You know, I'm disappointed with my performance. As long as you walk away going, yeah, that was everything I got, right? Then at least you walk away with a sense of accomplishment. And having a win-learn mindset was a game changer for me selling. And I've taken that on in life that, you know, it's not always easy. And look, sometimes things happen. And look, again, like the pandemic, my business fell off a cliff. I wasn't going.
Like many. Yeah, exactly.
Interesting learning experience. You know, I was devastated, but I had to regroup quickly. And the quickest way to regroup is to reframe, right? And to pull the situation. And that isn't to say that bad news is good. It's a paradox, though. You know, it's to reframe the situation in such a way that at least generates a sense of, you know, capability. And then you go again. And then you play a win-learn-change strategy moving forward as well. So, yeah, that was a pivotal for me back in the day.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think a lot of people would think of it the other way around, as in change, learn, win, rather than win, learn, change. So it's an interesting approach. And I think it seems to me that it would obviously be much more successful in terms of a life hack.
If you just say once a week, if you had a journal, if people are into journaling, if you had a journal and once a week you make a note, just a paragraph. What were the wins this week? What were the standout moments? What worked? You know, I know it sounds obvious, but people don't catch those winning moments and don't remind themselves that often. It's almost like, well, yeah, that's expected of me. I go, well, maybe not. Doesn't matter. The point is, you recognize it. You sensitize yourself and your brain to notice I value that. I like it when those things happen. That in itself causes you to think more about those things. It's a bit like if you went out and bought a new car today, if you went out and bought a grey Audi, you know, what do you start seeing for the next few days?
Grey Audis.
You're not even looking for them, but you start to notice them because you're sensitized. So how do you sensitize your brain to notice those things that you want? Well, remind yourself. So make it a note of some of the wins for the week and then draw a line and go, so what are some of the lessons? What did I learn? Maybe one thing that if I could do it again, I'd change it. Or I learned that I probably need to upskill in certain areas. What would that be? Just note it and go, based on my learning, if there's one thing I'm going to change, what would it be? Well, I'm going to make sure I change that. I'm going to really focus on that specific thing for the next week or so. I tell you, I've done this with many clients, and they go, if you do this once a week, I'm talking 10 minutes, right? Mm. You will see over the course, if you look at the journal entries over the next 8 weeks, what you start to see is patterns. And you will see patterns, because if the same learning keeps showing up, what that's suggesting is you're not actually changing anything.
Yeah.
So at least be mindful of that, right? And if you do become mindful and you do start pursuing the change, what you will see, and this is almost without exception, is you see progress. You see progress. You see more wins showing up the longer you do. So maybe it's not something you've got to do every week forever, but you know, maybe twice a year for 2 8-week blocks, you plug it in and go, just raise your awareness a little bit about about the way you're operating.
Yeah, journaling can be really powerful, and you can apply it to any area of your well-being or your life generally, that you want to get on the right track. Time for another break now, though. We'll be back right after this from our sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
You're listening to Alchemy 101, and we're back with more from Jim Steele, the author of Unashamedly Superhuman: Harness Your Inner Power and Achieve Your Greatest Professional and Personal Goals. Well, the book isn't all about exercise and sport, but I couldn't help mentioning the list of 40, that's 40, conditions and diseases that exercise will help us fend off.
Yeah, I mean, I had to put that in. When I was doing the research, you know, the chapter is the big three to thrive. And the big three to thrive are sleep, exercise and nutrition. These are the big ones. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I'm not pitching myself as an expert in these areas. I'm a participant. right? I'm exploring these with you. But I did my research on these three very important, critical, fundamental areas. So when I talked about exercise, I was just going, look, it would seem that exercise assists you in all manner of ways. So if exercise isn't a fundamental part of your strategy, make it so. I'm not talking about training for a triathlon. I'm talking about regular movement, you know, regular patterns. And I mean, I have some great data I've seen since I wrote the book about longevity and about cognitive function, saying the number one strategy for cognitive function is physical exercise because of the oxygen transfer.
Yeah.
You know, with a lymph moving around your system, you know, even if it's 30 minutes a day, three or four times a week, I know it sounds obvious and, you know, I don't want to sound too obvious and I try and steer away from that, but there are some things that just make sense, right? And exercise is one of those things. And, you know, I was listening to a doctor talking about how much should somebody do? Well, you know, then you're getting into sort of tricky waters because we've all got our own take on this, right? We've all got our own beliefs about what's right, what's wrong, what you should or shouldn't do. Nutrition is a whole other story.
Well, yes.
It's a barbed wire topic.
We could talk a whole for a day on nutrition, of course. Yeah.
But I think with exercise, this doctor was saying, do as much if you're not training for something. So let's separate those two things out. And my take on it when I talk about it is about being goal focused. If you've got a goal to do something, to be something, to create something, your strategy should suit the goal. If I'm not training for a triathlon, my strategy changes. Right. I don't do this 15 hours a week training, but I'll have a maintenance strategy. And maintenance could be literally 15 minutes a day. It could be a bit of stretching. It could be some sort of yoga, something that's a little less impactful. It could be walking rather than running, but it'll be something. And he was saying about doing press-ups. He said, how many press-ups did you do? And he said, well, as many as you can do where you'll do it every day. If you try and bang out 30 press-ups and you collapse in agony, you're not going to do that every day. Right. So do five. Do five. Every day for the rest of your life. He said, that's the mentality of maintenance. So exercise hasn't got to be this join a gym, invest loads of money. I mean, it could be if you've got a significant goal. It's just having some patterns, some habits that just lend itself well to putting you into a state of well-being. Because all the data would suggest, and I think we all know this, by the way, I'm not trying to pitch this, would suggest it makes sense. The thing is, sometimes there's a gap between common sense and common practice, right?
Yeah.
You know, so maybe we can talk about habits later as well, because there's a process I use for building habits, which just works.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's talk about habits. Tell me about your strategy for habit forming.
Well, with habits, I looked into this, and there's a couple of people I reference in the book a number of times. One of them is a guy called Professor Andrew Huberman. Andrew Huberman's based in Stanford. And look, if you want to dive deep into all manner of things around the human condition, you know, check him out, HubermanLab.com, and you'll see podcasts on anything and everything. Honestly, the guy, I think I say at the front of the book that if he doesn't know everything about everything, maybe I'm exaggerating, but only slightly. So because he's, you know, he's putting in the data, the research, peer reviewed. And I went to him quite a lot to reference things that I was exploring. But as far as habits goes, and I was reading some of his data on this, he was saying that you've got to recruit more than just logic, because logic clearly doesn't work. There's three things that I would talk to around habit formation. One is use logic, but use logic in a way that it reduces friction. So you think about what are the two or three things you want to do more of. So maybe it might be some sort of exercise, let's say. So, I mean, look, behind me, you'll see my bike in the background.
It's not very popular having
my bike set up in the lounge.
No.
But we've only got one room really here. So if I don't put it there, it's up in the garage. And then I've got to bring it in because it's too cold. It's too icy right now. Mm-hmm. I've got to bring it in, set it up on the trainer. I get a bit of oil on me. Then I've got to dismantle it at the end. Frankly, that's too much friction. So I'm not going to do it every day. But because it's there, I'm going to jump on that every day, at least 5-6 days a week. You know, training is one thing, but getting yourself to do the thing, that's a whole other challenge. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what can you do that reduces the friction between you and the thing you want to become a habit, right?
Yeah.
So that's the first thing. That's logical. Then you tap in emotion. Emotion is, you know, having the conversation with yourself about what's the consequence if I don't do this thing over time? Like, if I don't do this for the next 12 months, what's the impact of that? You know, what are the benefits of making this happen? How will I be in a year if this is a pattern of behavior that's just part of who I am? And when you build in some emotion, some motive, at least you fire up some adrenaline, you get a bit of dopamine, you go, okay, I really want to do this. But even that's not enough. So then I would say, you know, the classic time frame on habits, I don't know how accurate it is. 21 days is a phrase we often hear. 21 days to form a habit. Let's use that as the benchmark. The problem with 21 days is after 10 days, three of the things I decided I wanted to do, I've only done one of them, the last three. I've been so busy, I haven't had time to do it. So after 15 days, I'm like, oh, look, I've screwed up again. I've failed. Let's forget about it. I've got better things to do. It's too disappointing, right? So what I would suggest people do is they block it down into 7 3-day challenges. So for the next 3 days, I've got three things I want to do each day. I want to put in 30 minutes exercise. I want to do a little bit of breath work because I find it helps me calm down and de-stress. And maybe I want to get a little cold therapy, cold shower, take a swim, get some cold air, whatever it might be, or go for a walk and whatever. So they're my three things for the next 3 days. And then after 3 days, pause and reflect. Did I? Yes and no. Okay, right. Well, I'm building in a bit of human error here. So now we're going to start again for the next 3 days. You wipe the slate clean. For the next 3 days, my intention is to do these three things and then go about your business. Reflect back after 3 days. Did I? Yes, and yes. Okay, just wipe the slate clean. You can't, you know, don't feel good that you did it. Just go, I did it. Next 3 days. Yes, no. What happens is because you're recruiting 3-day blocks of time, each 3 days you get a reset of expectation, a reset of adrenaline, a little bit of dopamine. You know, you're getting these neurochemicals on side. So it's not just logic and emotion. You've got neurochemistry on your side. And what'll happen, again, I've tested this many times, not just me, but with people that I've worked with, after 7 3-day blocks where you reset and go again, at the end of the 21 days, 1, 2, sometimes even 3 of these things will be habits. One, definitely, you'll have formed some way where this is just part of who you are. And once it becomes your thing, and I mean that, and I use that phrase in the book, the thing is, once it's your thing, so cold water swimming, it's your thing. You're the kind of go-to person. Once it becomes your thing, then you haven't got to worry about it. You will always find time for it. It becomes a priority. Right. Yeah. If it's not your thing, if it's always, well, I'm trying to do it, but it's not me. It's not really me, but I'll give it a go. I'm not really built like that. Running's not my thing. Well, until it becomes your thing, I promise you, it won't be part of your life forever.
No, that's
so.
Is
how do you
so
make
true.
It your thing? Yeah. Block it into 7 3-day sections, yeah. And then it becomes more your thing.
And also reducing the friction. Now, I totally relate to that because talking about the swimming, the open water swimming, cold water swimming, when I first started, I think I started in March. It's still quite cold and I still hadn't acclimatized. And, you know, maybe once or twice I stayed in a bit too long.
Right.
So, you know, I was shivering and I used to walk because I thought, oh, for heaven's sake, you know, it's not far to the sea. I'll just walk down there. And then I realized that one day when I was walking back, it was just a bit too far while I was shivering and I didn't go again for 2 weeks.
Mm.
And then I had a little talk to myself and said, so what's stopping you from doing it? Well, it's the walk back if I get too cold. And I thought, well, who's going to laugh at you for taking your car and parking closer to where you're going in? Nobody. And I tell you what, lots of people do it because the last thing you want to do is to put something into your head which will stop you getting the benefit.
Yeah. I mean, you're greasing the wheels. You're removing the friction.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. So I'm sitting here as living proof that that works.
Yeah, it's more than logical. I mean, it is logical, but you're then triggering some feel good emotions. You're feeling good about the thing. And similarly, when I was started training for this triathlon, there's a lake which I swim at. And similarly, it wasn't my thing. I mean, exercise wasn't my thing, let alone swimming for like 90-minute bursts. Was like, it took a lot of working up to.
Of course.
You know, but you go, what can I do to make it easy? What can I do to make it a little easier? It's hard enough as it is sometimes, you know. So one, you know, what can you do? One, you work on the friction. So similarly, I bought something to put on when I got out. So
of
I
course.
Knew I'd be That's immediately, like, I could be, oh, I'll be warm. You know, because I didn't the first few times.
Right.
And like you, I wasn't enjoying the process.
Yeah.
And then it's trying to add in some purpose to it. So it's not just a practical strategy for well-being and health. I'm making it more purposeful, more meaningful. You know, this is what you're doing, you're becoming better at something that's really challenging. what is that? How does that impact other areas of your life? You know, you're building resilience. You can't give somebody resilience. It's a misnomer. You can't even give someone confidence. You can make them feel good, but you can only build confidence and resilience through stepping into difficult, challenging situations willfully. And that's the key, you know, reminding ourselves. At times I did this when I was training, and even on the day I did this triathlon, you know, halfway through the ride, I reminding myself, you've chosen this.
Yes.
You chose to do this. Reminding yourself it's a willful pursuit. You know, it sounds so simple, but you know, when you said I had a word with myself, self-talk is huge in situations like this. Self-talk creates friction, you know.
Yes.
So
yes,
yeah, making it willful is key. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And talking about resilience, I do find that having now done this as an almost daily practice now for the last 2 years, I find my resilience has skyrocketed in every area of life.
Yeah. And you know, similarly, I found with a number of these hacks that they are pervasive, that when this becomes part of who you are in this part of your day, the impact it has. And I found the same with the cold. So I've used, like you, I've used cold water because it's cheap and it's easy and there's no skill involved. So I thought, well, look, I'm going to do anything I can that gives me an edge that frankly I can do, because, you know, I don't know how to do this triathlon, but I can definitely have a cold shower or jump in an ice bath or go for a swim. I can definitely do some breath works and breathing protocols that similarly, you know, don't take much working out. It takes a bit of discipline, but once you get into the habit of doing it, and then like you, what I just found was, I don't know, I found that life seemed to be 10% more manageable. I don't know how to quantify it, but everything seemed to be at 10% easier to deal with, right? And if that's the outcome, I'll never not do these things, because I've seen the difference and I felt the difference. And again, it takes a little bit of time and a little bit of focus, you know, but the rewards, it would seem anyway. I think another good example of that is meditation. Yes. I almost couldn't say meditation out loud without squirming. It just wasn't my thing. I just never got the whole thing. I was never going to sit there right like this. But I read an article, and everything that I talked to, as you'll see in the book, is referenced and peer reviewed as best that it can be. But, you know, not everything. Some things are intuitive. But meditation was one of those things. When I started looking into it and finding out that when you even take the word meditation out, because that will freak some people out, just let's just say focus and refocus. So a focus and refocus strategy. What I learned was 15 minutes, two or three times a week of something, let's call meditation, focus, refocus, recruits the circuits in the brain to be able to handle distraction. I thought, that's interesting. And I tell you, I read a really interesting article by a guy called Justin Rosenstein in The Guardian. And he talked about how the senior programmers at Google, Twitter, and Instagram were disconnecting themselves from the very platforms they made to be addictive. Mm. He said he even had to adjust his operating system to keep him out of Snapchat, which he classed as a class A drug in terms of addiction.
Wow.
And he said the like button, what the phrase he used was a pseudo ding of pleasure. That's a phrase he used. He said, and by the way, he should know, because he created the like button. He designed it at Facebook. Originally, it was called the awesome button. Right? And he was saying that on average, people spend on average 3 hours a day on social media, on average. 2,600 taps, swipes on their phone a day. Now, I mean, that's not you and me, but the others.
No, right? Exactly.
That's the average. And he was saying, but the problem with that is, you know, distractions fracture our focus. It fractures our ability to focus on things. So we're almost training ourselves to be distracted. And he said, you know, what price your attention? You know, how do you stay tuned in a world of noise? So when I started looking into this, and I was looking into meditation as an example, and it was a professor in NYU initially. She's now at Stanford. Wendy Suzuki, her name was. And she was talking about a 13-minute meditation where she said, all you do, and this was a science-based approach, so it wasn't anything West Coast. She was saying, you sit quietly, close your eyes, focus on your breathing like they all do. Focus on a spot behind your forehead, which is what apparently they all do. And what you'll find after about 30 seconds, you'll be thinking about yesterday,
afternoon, yeah.
Right? Right. And she says, now most people go, oh, I can't do this. I failed at it. And she went, no, that's the point. That's it. What you do is you notice the fact you're distracted, then you refocus back on your breathing.
Yeah.
And then within a minute, you'll be off thinking about other things. So, oh, I've done it again. Refocus back on your breathing, back on this point behind your forehead. Keep doing that for 13 minutes. It's a very specific amount of time. Twice a week will be enough. It doesn't take much more than that. And she said, what you're doing is you're recruiting the neural circuits to cause you to refocus in a world of distraction, in a world of noise. Oh, my God. So when I tried this and I started doing this regularly, and by the way, this has been a 3-year process now. So, and I haven't barely missed a day on most of these little hacks. I'm not all of them, but most of them I'm using as part of my routine. All I noticed, and again, I've had enough data from people I work with, within a matter of days, this isn't months, within a matter of days, you mentioned pragmatic strategies and hacks. Mm. I just noticed that when I got back into my day, I was less distracted. I mean, I started managing my environment a little better. So I switched off all my notifications. So I still don't have any notifications on my phone. If I need an email, I got to go and look for it. Text, yeah. I got to go and open them.
Me too.
So nothing's coming through ad hoc. So it causes you to do things that lend itself to being focused, right? And to be able to concentrate in a world of noise. So meditation for me is not this soft option of just chilling. It's a hard strategy for training the brain to focus in a world where, you know, everyone wants a bit of your attention, right?
Yeah.
So that to me, with the, and all these slightly sort of left field hacks, I think they're grounded in hard neuroscience, you know?
Oh, no, I think they are. And so the book, again, because we're coming to the end of our time now,
yeah,
is Unashamedly Superhuman by Jim Steele, and available at all good places that sell books, I guess. So
yes. stores on Amazon.
Absolutely. Yeah. can't miss out the A word. So Jim, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about all of this. Couldn't go into everything. Obviously, anybody who's listening, whose interest has been piqued, do go and buy the book, because I think you'll find it well worth it. And that's all we have time for, sadly. Remember, you can find the UK Health Radio podcast wherever you listen to your favourites. Just search for Alchemy 101 to find my shows. And if you like what you hear, do check out our sister publication, Health Triangle magazine. You can access that at ukhealthradio.com. Join me next time here on Alchemy 101. But until then, it's goodbye from me and, of course, that nightingale.